When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
BSM presents The Tim Meisberg Show, streaming live on WBSM.com and the WBSM app. Call 508-996-0500. Send us app chat messages and open line voicemails using the WBSM app. Now, The Tim Meisberg Show.
And welcome back in, third and final hour here on a Monday morning. That means it's time to turn on the light with Jack Spillane of New Bedford Light. Good morning, Jack. How are you?
Hey there, Tim.
Before we turn on the light, how was your weekend?
My weekend was good. I played some tennis. High Point was a 90th birthday party for retired Standard Times editor Ken Hartnett, who has become a personal friend of mine. It was very nice. His family came up from New York. Some folks that I've worked with over the years, it was nice. A deserved tribute to a great man, in my opinion.
And last time I saw him, he certainly didn't look 90.
No. Ken has had some health challenges. He had a stroke, but he's a fighter. He always recovers, and he's in there causing trouble as much as ever.
Well, if he's listening, happy birthday, Ken. And I think that, you know, there's people who have kind of helped to shape the way that we view news here on the South Coast, and he played a big role in that.
Yeah, big role in the way he revamped the Standard Times when he came in the mid-90s. And also, I think it's fair to say that Ken Hartnett was the initial moving force behind the New Bedford Light. So
I remember when I was, you know, started to cover football, I started to cover the NFL as a whole, and he would call me into his office to tell me stories about covering Vince Lombardi and the Green Bay Packers.
Well, Ken, as you know, started out as a sports reporter like so many great editors. And he had some great stories about Vince Lombardi. He's even told me those stories.
All right, well, let's get started here. Let's cue up the Rolling Stones so that we can turn on the light. Could I think, get And although that's the Rolling Stones once had a cover of Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. Wasn't really nearly as good as the original.
I am not familiar with that.
Oh, yeah, no. When I saw them in concert, that was when they were playing it. I think they still do play it kind of regularly live, but it was pretty basic. It was pretty straightforward.
The Rolling Stones playing Like a Rolling Stone.
I mean, you knew it had to happen at some point.
Yeah, I always wonder whether, you know, because the Stones, to my memory, and I was alive at the time, were out before Dylan released that song, and I always wondered who was derivative of who.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Of course, Rolling Stone is sort of a term of art.
Right, you get the Rolling Stone gathers no moss type of sentiment, but I don't know. I mean, if Bob Dylan gives somebody their seal of approval, then you know that they're somebody who has had a major impact.
Well, that topic of Bob Dylan's seal of approval dovetails into what my last column was. I had done a lengthy column on Paul Clayton, a very important folk singer who grew up in New Bedford, very influential, although not known nowadays so much, in the Greenwich Village scene of the early 1960s. Did a lot of cataloging and recording of sea shanties and Appalachian mountain music, English broadside ballads, and was a big influence on Bob Dylan when Dylan first came to New York City, because Dylan came seeking Woody Guthrie, but his original plan had been to be a rock star, which I'm not sure he would have been able to pull off, but folk music he did. And he needed to learn about folk music. It was not, what he, was all about originally. And he learned a lot of it at the, as well as Joan Baez, at the foot of Paul Clayton.
So why do you think it is that Clayton isn't as well known? Why did he kind of get lost through the cracks of folk history?
Well, he recorded one time, he billed himself as the most recorded young folk singer in America. Of course, it was Woody Guthrie and some others earlier on. But he was more of a purist. He would record these songs in the way that they were sang in the mountains or on the ships and or in the rural parts of England and France. And so he was not trying to reinvent them as sort of like confessional folk singing for the 1960s America, the way people like Dylan, Joni Mitchell, the Kingston Trio did. So he had this purist style, and then he had a lot of personal problems. He was gay in an era when it was not easy to be gay. He became a drug addict, and he had a lot of personal problems. There's a great story about he was the one who originally recorded the melody for Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, with which Dylan had a big hit, and Dylan got that song from him. Now, Clayton, in turn, got it from mountain music of the peoples of the Appalachians. He had adapted it and recorded it as a song of Who's Gonna Buy You Ribbons. And keep in mind, he was very close friends with Dylan, really seeing him every day, the big influence of my time. And Dylan came in one day and said, I'm going to make that song a hit. Dylan was a more talented, creative person. And he took the exact same melody, including a couple of the lines from the song, again, that Clayton had readapted and had a big hit with Don't Think Twice, It's All Right. And then Peter, Paul, and Mary had an even bigger hit with it afterwards, but the royalties would go to Dylan. There was a big controversy in Greenwich Village at the time as to whether Dylan should have given Clayton a co-writing credit, because Clayton was destitute at the time. He had no money, and people felt really angry at Dylan that he wouldn't give him part of the royalties. And Clayton's recording company took Dylan's recording company to court. Dylan's company countersued them, and they settled out of court for a very small sum for Clayton. And a lot of people in the village felt that Dylan was successful enough at the time that he could have, shared royalties for that one song with Clayton. Clayton had been a big influence on him. I think Dylan, I am an admirer of Dylan from a distance. I appreciate that he was the voice of that generation, the most gifted rock poet. But if you read about his personal life, he was very much a self-centered, person. He wanted people to think that his creativity came directly from the gods, that he wasn't influenced by other musicians or people. And I think it was small of him not to share that credit with Clayton, who a year later electrocuted himself by bringing an electric guitar into a bathtub full of water in his Greenwich Village apartment, which was a year after Dylan went electric at the Newport Folk Festival.
So we're kind of making a statement.
Yeah,
with
it's
his,
fascinating
with his
stuff. So Clayton is buried up in Oak Grove Cemetery. His mother lived another 10 years after he died. Many people knew her at the old Tryworks Coffee House in New Bedford. And he's another one of these New Bedford figures. There's a number of them. For a while, Frederick Douglass was forgotten. Now he's remembered. Marie Equi, Paul Clayton, even Melville for a while. Now we're going to have a statue of Melville. Many people say that the statue of Melville is about 100 years overdue. But so he's another one of these great New Bedford figures, very influential in the rebirth of folk music, in the revival, I guess is a better word, of folk music in the 1960s. Who's largely been forgotten.
Well, if Bob Dylan wants to make it up to him, he could pay to have a statue of Paul Clayton put up in New Bedford.
Yeah, I don't know about a statue, but some sort of memorial. should be. I mean, you could have a statue. The Whaling Museum, where he researched a lot of his materials, certainly could do a tribute program on Paul Clayton. You know, I think he was an important figure, and I think it was certainly a tragic ending for this talented man.
I'm surprised that he wasn't, kind of rediscovered or discovered, really, the last couple of years, because I don't know if you remember, but on TikTok during the pandemic, sea shanties became a huge trend where people were recording them and putting them out there, and it became really popular for a while. And people were looking for those traditional songs. I'm surprised they didn't get a surge in popularity from that.
I don't know about that, but there was a small revival when the movie 10 years ago, Inside Llewyn Davis, came out. Inside Llewyn Davis was about the folk music scene in the 1960s, and it traces a musician similar to Clayton who was not as commercially marketable as someone like Dylan. Although I think, when I listen to his music, I think it's great, and I don't, given the proper marketing people, I think he could have been a success. Whether he could have been a success being gay in the 1950s and 60s is another question. I don't know. It didn't take off for him, but I think that when that movie Inside Llewyn Davis came out, a lot of people saw it was a tragic figure who wasn't going to be commercially successful. The other part of his rock duo who had committed suicide, they had Justin Timberlake dressed up to look like Clayton. He was another minor folk singer in that time. So there have been these periods of revival of interest. Bob Coltman, a accomplished folk musician himself, wrote a very compelling biography of Clayton about 15 years ago. So there have been small revivals over time, but, you know, as I said in my column, his ghost continues to haunt folk music, and people who are in the know about him.
It is fascinating that era of folk music was such a, here it is becoming lucrative for probably the first time ever. And so that bred a lot of these problems that happened. But you have people who are taking traditional songs and maybe changing a couple of lyrics or changing the arrangement. And then all of a sudden they become the definitive version of that song, and then they own the rights to it. So the way that they borrowed so heavily from things that should have been traditional and should have been kind of anybody's, kind of for anybody to interpret the way they want to, it's just amazing how much it became so mired in business.
Yeah. And that, as we know, that even goes on in rock music and popular music today. Mm-hmm. The sampling and melodies that are similar, if not exactly the same. There are only so many melodies, I suppose, and people stumble upon them, or maybe they heard it and they're not consciously trying to do it. And we know the George Harrison suit was a famous suit. There was another one with Ed Sheeran. More recently, there have been countless examples of that over the years.
I think the craziest one was the John Fogerty case, where he was sued for sounding too much like himself.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Fogerty's was a tragic case, and I'm a big fan of Creedence Clearwater Revival. In Fogerty's case, he could not play his own music for a long time because he had signed a contract when he was young, and he didn't have the rights to it to play it the way he wanted to play it. Eventually, that contract ran out, and he can do it again now, but some of his big earning years, he did not have access to his own music.
I mean, imagine today doing, oh, sorry, you can't, we're going to sue you because that song sounds too much like this song that you already did. I can't help the way I sound. I'm going to sound the same way from one song to the other. And the two songs do sound kind of similar.
Yeah,
but
it happens. I do want to mention Gary Brown and Seth Astor. They are two local musicians who did this Paul Clayton program. And it was at Mattapoisett Museum last week. It was a three-hour program. We had lots of local musicians, including Butch McCarthy and Chris McCarthy's brother, Neil McCarthy, who performed. It was fascinating. They had, I wrote a script for them, which they partially used, and it retraced Clayton's life and what happened to him. There were all kinds of fascinating people from Greenwich Village and California. Hollywood producer was there who talked about his life. And so it still does compel people these years later.
Do you think there'll be a movie made about his life?
I don't think it's out of the question because, just think of the circumstances. Like, he has all this early success by recording all this music, but it's a success in folk music circles, not, broad commercially. And then he's a big influence on Dylan and Joan Baez and all those people. And then he dies so tragically by metaphorically killing himself as rock music is becoming folk, as folk music is becoming folk rock and electrified, it has all the makings of, and he's from New Bedford.
I could certainly see it. And that's a movie that I would watch.
Me too.
Well, you can read Jack's column at newbedfordlight.org, and it really is a great piece. And then you can do a dive on, and you can find some of his music online. And I mean, is that part of it? Do you think that the music needs to be more commercially available these days with all the different streaming services that people use to get their music?
Yeah. So a lot of his music was recorded but for these folk music obscure companies that are not widely commercially available. If you look hard, I have 7 or 8 of his CDs. I think he did 13 or 14 in total. Toward the end of his career, they were a little bit more commercial because he was trying to make that crossover. One of the challenges, I think, is that until last Thursday night when I saw it at the Mattapoisett Museum, there was no video of him. And somebody had a video of him performing at the Newport Folk Festival, and he was an accomplished guitarist, I can tell you. That video was shot off of a television monitor because the person in possession of it lives over in the Vineyard, my understanding, was involved in that whole folk music scene but does not wish to go public. And this person that shot it was there visiting him one time. But that's the only person that has access to video of Paul Clayton playing. And I think in the era we live with, so much is video, and there's no, I mean, most of these old performers, you can look up and find Early Dylan performing, mm-hmm. or Joni Mitchell, of all these people, and I don't think you can find him that easily. And so I think, but there's lots of this, any number of photographic images of him.
But you would have thought there'd be performances from like Hootenanny or Old Grey Whistle Test that would have survived the test of time, but he wasn't somebody that they saved the footage of, probably.
Yeah, and again, most of his recordings were done in the 1950s, so it's just before, you know, things like Hootenanny and, you know, the Kingston Trio and the Brothers Four and all them. God, I actually sound like I know what I'm talking about, which I don't.
Well, we can talk more about that, plus whatever else is on your mind. We're going to talk about some other issues with Jack coming up, including South Coast Rail. We'll talk about those weapons detectors that they are going to be installing at New Bedford High and other topics as well. But right now we're going to take our first break of the hour. We will be back in just a few moments. Rail. So today we're going to start to see trains going on those tracks, getting up to speeds of about 79 miles an hour as they're trying to test, you know, full strength. But we found out that we are almost a year away from the actual launch now of South Coast Rail.
You could almost write a novel about South Coast Rail, and the theme throughout it would be, it's coming, it's coming, it's not coming. It's coming, it's coming, yeah, it's not coming. And I understand why people are cynical, because every time it seems that it's within reach, something goes wrong. But now they've spent millions of dollars rebuilding it, and it may be an indirect route, but it's coming. You know, when they built that Green Line extension to Medford a few years ago, they built a track, the tracks too close together. And even though they had paid a consultant $1 million to make sure they were doing it right, it wasn't done right. And they had to tear up all those tracks and rebuild them. So I don't know what the holdup here is. They're calling it safety issues. But, you know, I guess it's better to get it right rather than to open it and then have to close it.
Right. That would kill any kind of, you know, rider confidence in it.
Yeah. So they're trying to get it right. The person who was in charge of it mysteriously left her job and was replaced by this other consultant who is a safety person a few months ago. The general manager, Philip Ang, who is a nationally renowned transportation expert who is now running the MBTA, trying to straighten it out, was in New Bedford, you know, talking about this latest delay until May. So it was supposed to open a year ago, fall, and then this July, this coming July, and now to the next May. And never mind all the delays back when Bill Weld and Deval Patrick were in power.
So. Which I do think that the May prediction might be a little bit shorter. So it might happen sooner than May, and they can look and say, well, look, we finished, you know, earlier than we thought that we would. I think it all depends on, you know, what the upcoming winter is like.
Yeah, I mean, you can see them building the new pedestrian bridge over Route 18. You can see the stations that they built at Church Street and at the Whales Tooth parking lot. It's coming, but it does seem that it is just a saga, that anything that can go wrong does go wrong.
I mean, when I saw the, you know, 48 hours notice press release that Philip Eng was coming to New Bedford and Fall River, I said, well, this can't be good.
Yes. Well, the New Bedford Light had been working on an investigation about the, you know, the fact that the MBTA, since they let this person left and was replaced by the new safety expert and the latest delay was announced, has said nothing about when it would be rescheduled. And, you know, I can't prove it, but I would say that we were about to publish that story and then all of a sudden Philip Eng announces that he's coming within 24 hours.
Oh, there you go. Well, we can talk some more about that coming up and take your calls 508-996-0500. But right now it is time to go into the newsroom and get all the headlines of the day from Phil Devitt.
A busy campaign weekend for Biden and Trump. The FAA investigating fake titanium in commercial jets and a bad driving habit you might want to cut out.
From the WBSM newsroom, this is WBSM News.
It was a busy weekend for both President Biden and former President Donald Trump at a fundraiser in Los Angeles Saturday featuring various A-list celebrities as well as former President Obama. Biden expressed concern over how a second Trump term would affect the United States Supreme Court. Biden's campaign says the event raised a record-breaking $30 million from Democratic donors. Trump, on the same day, made a pitch to African-American voters in Detroit, while once again also claiming that the election process is rigged. New York Senator Chuck Schumer says he's going to push Congress this week to restore a ban on bump stocks. Scott Pringle reports.
The bump stock allows a semi-automatic weapon to fire much quicker, and Senator Schumer says it should remain banned.
Gun bump stocks, like the one that took so many lives of people in Las Vegas, risks public safety, risks public tragedies, will certainly cost human lives.
The Trump administration banned bump stocks following the 2017 Las Vegas deadly mass shooting. However, the Supreme Court this past Friday ruled that the federal ban is unlawful. Scott Pringle, NBC News Radio, New York.
The FAA is investigating how potentially substandard titanium sold using fake documentation ended up in commercial jets. Caroline Malone with more.
The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration said on Friday it's looking into allegations from Spirit AeroSystems, which makes fuselages for major aviation companies. They've said paperwork for titanium from a Chinese company was falsified. Titanium is used on the Boeing 787 Dreamliner passenger entry and cargo doors and connections to the engine frame, and on a heat shield protecting connections around the engine of the 737 MAX and A220. Caroline Malone, Washington.
The remains of a World War II airman are now back home in Iowa. U.S. Army Air Force Second Lieutenant Max E. Daley's plane was shot down over Romania in August of 1943. His remains were positively identified in June of last year, after being recovered from an American cemetery in Belgium. Researchers at Michigan State University say honeybees can detect lung cancer. A team used a 3D printed harness to hold live bees and attach an electrode to their brains. The bees were presented with mixtures that replicated the human breath of someone who was healthy and someone with lung cancer. Researchers say the honeybees could distinguish between the different types of breath and detect small concentrations of cancer. Researchers are looking to create a non-invasive test that would make patients breathe into a device that has a sensor based on the honeybee brain. And more than 9 out of 10 Americans drive in the U.S. Bree Tennis with the most annoying thing you're doing on the road.
The Society of Automotive Engineers has listed the 3 most annoying habits behind the wheel, and you're probably doing them. They say 48% of drivers don't use their turn signal, and that's the most annoying trait. 80% tailgate, another 80% use their phone, all while driving a 4,000-pound vehicle, probably over the posted speed limit, too. On the plus side, they say 91.9% of us use a seatbelt. I'm Bree Tennis.
WBSM Sports.
Good night for the Red Sox. They beat the Yankees 9-3. Next up, a game of the Blue Jays in Toronto tonight at 7. And the Celtics aiming to close out the NBA Finals on home court. Boston hosting the Dallas Mavericks in Game 5 of the NBA Finals tonight at 8:30.
Now, your ABC 6 South Coast forecast, brought to you by C Street.
We'll see tons of sunshine for your forecast for today. Temperatures are going to top out around 78 along the South Coast. For tonight, you can expect partly cloudy skies, a low low near 64. And for Tuesday, look for lots of sunshine with a high closer to 82. Be sure to watch ABC 6 for my full 7-day forecast. From the ABC 6 Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Kelly Bates on New Bedford's News Talk Station, 1420 WBSM.
This WBSM News Update is brought to you by Stevie's Wine and Spirits. Look for the purple dot to try before you buy. Only at Stevie's Wine and Spirits in Fairhaven. I'm Phil Devitt for WBSM News. Stay up to date with New Bedford's News Talk Station, WBSM, and get all of our content and breaking news alerts with the WBSM app.
And welcome back in. We are turning on the light with Jack Spillane of New Bedford Light. And we were talking about South Coast Rail, and we were talking about this, you know, delay again. And you mentioned that you've heard that there are still people that think that it's not going to happen. Is that true? You really do encounter people who believe it's not going to happen?
I'm just speaking anecdotally. Like, you know, I hear them occasionally on the radio.
We get them here.
When I run into people, I think it's fewer than before. But, you know, for a long time, you know, people were very, very cynical about it because, you know, you had the whole thing about, you know, Weld saying that he would deliver it and it didn't happen. Then Deval Patrick came in and he was going to do it. Mitt Romney put a stop to it. You know, it's just, it's been a lot of stops and starts over the years. I also think that there are some people out there that are just prejudiced against mass transportation. They think the internal combustion engine, you know, that automobiles are really the only way to have efficient transportation, maybe buses. I don't know. Anybody who drives to Boston now knows that, you know, they've expanded the Southeast Expressway to about as far as you can expand it. Mm-hmm. Even Route 24 now is busy at all times. I just don't know, as the population grows, that we can be totally reliant on cars. I think you're going to have to think of a better way to get to places like Boston and Providence in particular. And one suggestion that former Mayor Lang sometimes makes is connecting to Attleboro, which goes either way to Boston or Providence, and that maybe that's how they should have connected rather than going directly to Boston. I get that, although I think there was something to be said for a direct route, because who wants to get on one train and then have to get off and get on another train?
And that doesn't mean you still can't eventually expand toward Attleboro.
Yeah, and even going to Boston is a problem somewhat, because if you work in the Back Bay or Beacon Hill, you're being left off at South Boston, you know, where South Station is, and you have to change and get on the subway, and that can be a long delay. They should have connected North and South Stations when they did the big dig 30 years ago, and that was the original plan, was to connect them. It was going to be even more expensive, and there were a lot of scandals and cost overruns with the big dig, although I think now everybody appreciates being able to drive through that tunnel. It's much quicker than the Southeast Expressway ever was. But they didn't connect it, and now there's a couple of problems with that. There's no storage space for the trains, and you have to get off, and if you work in another part of Boston or Cambridge, you have to make another connection. So We need to improve mass transit in New England.
I would also argue too that it might be, you know, the future of this might be also connecting New Bedford to Wareham, and giving people the option of getting on the Cape Flyer in New Bedford. And then that way there, you know, you don't have to go and deal with the bridges, and you might see a lot of people then utilizing that line because they'd much rather come to New Bedford, spend some time in New Bedford, get on the train, go over to the Cape, spend the day on the Cape, and come back.
So that's the old line that used to go from Wareham to Providence. And I've been told, I don't know if it's in the Wareham part of it, but the problem is that parts of that line have been sold to private parties. And so the state is no longer in control of it. And to get that line going again would be expensive, because you'd have to buy it, you know, even if you took it by eminent domain. But, you know, we just need to improve mass transit, whether it's going to be. Remember a few years ago they were talking about these like tubes,
Hyperloop.
The Hyperloop. It's
an Elon Musk idea. Yeah,
but it's clear that I mean, it takes a long time to get to Boston by car now, and there it used to be, oh well, I'm going to avoid rush hour, but now there's not very many times where it's easy. Maybe in the middle of the night.
I was kind of excited for that Hyperloop idea. You could have gone from here to Boston in 15 minutes. Could have gone from here to Washington, D.C. in 45.
Well, if somebody can do it, you know, maybe Elon Musk or somebody can figure it
but
out.
It was but his company that was doing it.
Yeah. But so where is it?
And well, the problem is they put out this. They took bids from all these different states for organizations that would do it, and it wasn't Massachusetts that was selected.
Well, so, where is it anyway, though? I don't know
if it's still in the process, if it's still in the works.
Yeah. Maybe he got sidetracked by SpaceX.
Well, the pandemic happened, which could probably slow some things down, but it's not like Elon Musk doesn't have the money to keep it going. Speaking of things that are supposed to be for the betterment of the area, it looks like that the Business Improvement District might have some issues here going forward.
Yeah, this has been a difficult issue. I spoke to it last time I was here. And, since that time, Marcos Lemandri, I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly, has bowed out. And that was one of my concerns that I just didn't think. I thought this had to be more organic. And I did not think that you could run a successful business improvement district with half the merchants in downtown New Bedford opposing it. I think it has to be overwhelmingly popular for it to succeed. I mean, when you have key merchants like Devin Burns of Destination Soups, Brandon Roderick of The Baker, No Problemo, Calico, these are prominent people in town having concerns about it. I think the problem with it, to my mind, and it does have some potential, you know, to do things that the city can't afford to do. But the problem is that it seems heavily weighted to the owners of the buildings. And so that has made the owners of businesses that rent space in a building wary of it because they fear that the costs are going to be passed on to them. Now, I've heard the argument that why would we pass on the costs when that would hurt us? We want it to succeed. Well, building owners are trying to make a living like everybody else, and if they have assessments to pay, they're going to pass on the cost. That's how capitalism works. And so they did not get buy-in from some of these prominent downtown businesses, and I think if it's ever going to succeed, they're going to have to get that buy-in.
So do you think that now it really should be, like you said, a grassroots effort of these businesses that are down there to say, okay, you don't want this, but maybe you should be doing something. Maybe more focus should be put on DNB Inc. Maybe there should be some more working together. And I know the business owners, I know what they're going to say. We're busy just trying to run our own businesses here.
Well, I've talked to a few of them, and I don't think they're absolutely against it, but they want some guarantees. A lot of the proposals have been very vague, something like between 5 and 25 member board that would be running it. Well, first of all, who chooses the board? These successful businesses are going to want some guarantees that they would have, you know, a significant number of seats on that board. And I'll just give the example of the New Bedford Retirement Board, which I wrote about recently. There are 5 members. 2 of them are elected by the retirement system members, which are always union people. 2 of them are controlled by the mayor. And then the other 4 vote for the 5th one. So I think at least 1/3 of these seats somewhere in that vicinity are going to have to be controlled by the people who actually run businesses, not people who own buildings. People who own buildings can have some of the seats too. But if you want to get buy-in that people are not going to be at a disadvantage in something that they have no voice in, you're going to have to convince, you know, I mean, Jay Lanigan is a perfect example. He was against it 10 years ago. Now he's for it. So they convinced him. They're going to have to convince people like Devin Burns, Brandon Roderick, Elisa Paquette from Calico. And I'm embarrassed. I'm forgetting Jeff of No Problemo's last name. I've known him forever. Jeff, don't be mad at me. But Craig Piver. I'm saying Jeff. Jeff is Brick. Jeff Coggins, I think, is his name.
So it seems like there's a need for, you know, at least some working together on the part of these business owners, which they've always kind of done organically anyway, but maybe just like a more formalized, you know, banding together of them.
Yeah.
And maybe this is what did it.
I think the business owners have always worked together organically. I'm not sure the people who have proposed the business improvement district have really got the buy-in organically that they needed.
All right.
That's just my take.
We can take some calls on that, 508-996-0500. But right now, let's take a break. We'll be back in just a few moments. Going to be spent on these weapons detectors for New Bedford High School that really kind of seemed to have come as a surprise to people.
Yeah. I want to start off by saying I'm not against weapons detectors per se. I think that in this day and age, a sad fact of the way everything is, you may need them. And I have been at the high school enough to know that there's a lot of people through there, and discipline and order is not what it used to be. They do a good job. We haven't had the problems that they've had in Brockton, but I think weapons detectors are needed. But the way that they went about this, I think, is upset a couple of school committee members. Both Colleen DeWicke and Melissa Costa voted against it. And evidently, at the end of the year, when they transfer money from various budgets that haven't spent it, Superintendent Andrew O'Leary proposed transferring $700,000 for these weapons detector systems. Now, back in March, they had an executive session, and that's a closed-door session, where they talked about the possible need for weapons detectors, but there was no proposal that we would like to do this. And DeWicke and Costa objected to the fact that you bring this transfer to us without us even knowing that you're considering doing a proposal for a major policy change to implement a screening system like that is a major policy. Other schools have done it. You know, it's not unique to New Bedford. New Bedford is a big school. You know, and I think that's one of my issues with, I think New Bedford needs a couple of high schools. I think that that size of school doesn't work so well. They tell me that they're all in houses and they're segregated. But if you've ever been there during the day, it's a lot of kids. So I'm not against it per se, but I do think that there is a penchant in some aspects of the Mitchell administration for doing things quietly and if not behind closed doors, without a lot of publicity. And I get it. You know, whenever you raise something that could be controversial, there's going to be pushback. There's going to be people who don't like the idea. And so you tend to try to do it at the last minute and announce it as a done deal. That's not good government, I don't think. I think the city council has complained about that approach for a long time. I've known Superintendent O'Leary for a long time. I admire him. But perhaps some more talk about, I'd like to propose this, should have been on the table.
And part of the complaint about it, too, is that these systems don't have, you know, a high efficiency rate of working.
Good point. That was brought out in Colin's article in the New Bedford Light. So if you're going to have this kind of a system, and it seemed like particularly knives were able to get through. If they don't work, then why spend the money? I mean, is that the same thing at an airport or other public buildings that we have to go, you know, any government building in Boston? Now, there's always a metal detector. Do they not work also?
So, well, those are also different types of systems.
Okay, so is it just this system that has the bad failure rate? You know, so if there had been a formal proposal, I think some of these things might have been discussed more. The majority of the school committee voted for it. I do think that sometimes things get to be a rubber stamp, that the real business is done behind closed doors. That's not just a problem in New Bedford. It's a problem in government everywhere, I think, and
it's an approach of, this is what we're doing, and then if you're against it, well, how could you be against it? It's such a good idea. Why would you be against
but
it?
But it's the attitude, this is what we're doing, as we'd like to make a proposal. We're thinking of doing this. What do you think?
So, I mean, the other side of that argument of the efficacy rate of it would be, well, you know, something's better than nothing.
Just the way you said that, you know, something's better than nothing. I'm not sure I agree with that. Maybe
I kind of would like to see the data of how many weapons they've confiscated and how many times they think that there's been an issue in the building.
I mean, certainly there have been enough terribly unnerving shootings at American schools. You know, we just came up on the anniversary of Newtown that you know, arguing for metal detecting systems is certainly not unreasonable. And I think certainly not unreasonable at a high school level. And I just think people would have liked to know more about it and had a more methodical process to research it.
And from my understanding, these would be the kind of detectors where the kids would just walk through. There wouldn't be any stop and screen. You would just walk through and it would alert if there was something that set it off.
Yeah, and as you said, it does have this high failure rate. The examples I think Colin gave were knives. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know more about firearms.
Well, we can talk some more about that. We got to take our final break. We'll be back in just a few minutes as we are wrapping up Turning on the Light with Jack Spillane. We'll be right back. All right, and we're going to be wrapping things up with Jack in just a moment. But before we do that, I want to let you know, if you're looking for a way to get out there and, you know, kind of celebrate the everyday, the celebrations that are going on all month long, the graduations, Father's Day, it's all winding down now. So now it's time to celebrate you. Take a little time to sit back, relax, and enjoy yourself at Sunrise Bakery and Coffee Shop, 506 Bolton Street in New Bedford. It's where you can get some of their delicious fresh-baked pastries, muffins, donuts. They're made fresh every day. You can get sandwiches for lunch like casserole, chicken salad, tuna salad, linguica, and cheese rolls, all made on their fresh-baked Portuguese bread and pops. Everything there is so delicious, and it's a real treat for yourself. So check out Sunrise Bakery and Coffee Shop, 506 Bolton Street in New Bedford. It's a sensational continental feel. That's Sunrise Bakery and Coffee Shop. So, Jack, in the final minute that we have here or so, I know you're in semi-retirement. Is this a writing week or is this a tennis week?
Well, I think all weeks are both, but I'm just not writing as often. So I have fewer deadlines. I have a few things I'm working on, but I usually keep those things in my pocket.
Sure. Well, then that just means people should check out newbedfordlight.org every day.
Exactly. I don't know if I'll have something this week, but we'll have lots of other good stuff in the New Bedford Light, as always.
Are you enjoying the extra time to yourself?
I am. As I said to a few people, I'm just trying to smell a few roses. Anybody who's been in journalism know that it's a constant pace, and you're always feeding the beast, as they say, because every day is a new day, and you have to have news every day. So it's a little better pace for me at this stage.
Well, I'm glad it's working out for you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.